For many blind and partially sighted people, becoming an astronaut and going into space might be an impossible dream. For one man, Sina Baran, president of Prime Access Consulting, this dream has come one step closer. As a member of the Mission Astro Access team, he recently experienced weightlessness and zero gravity in a parabolic flight. Sina joins me now here on RNIB Connect Radio, all the way from North Carolina, to tell me more about the experience. Hello, Sina, and welcome to Connect Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sina, I believe going into space is something that you've always dreamt of since the age of four. What is it about space that fascinates you as a blind person?
I think it just fascinates me as a human, right? Not necessarily just as someone who's blind. It's an incredible frontier. We have so much we don't know. You know, and to me, I think like the biggest areas that we have right now that we don't know so much about is like the human brain. That's just, you know, fascinating to me. The ocean. We have so much underwater on this planet, two, three times more than is above water. And we haven't explored all of that. And then it's the universe. It's the rest of the universe we're in, which is arguably the most amount of unknown. And so I've always been fascinated by learning new things and by pushing that boundary of human knowledge. And for me, you know, space is the best manifestation of that. But also the constraints are different, right? When we're on Earth, you know, we have gravity, we walk around, etc. If we use our feet to move around, you know, that kind of thing. In space, that's not how it works, right? You're not inside of a gravity well. And so everything is different. And that's fascinating to just be in a completely different environment. I think is wonderful and enjoyable and exciting, but it also is a way of level setting. Because on Earth, if you're a person with a disability, you're living within a disabling environment, right? Sometimes unintentionally disabling and otherwise, other times not. But in space, you know, we have to reset for everybody. And so it's this great opportunity to reset in such a way that we can build a more inclusive future.
When did you first hear about Mission Astro Access, and what did you have to do to get the opportunity to experience weightlessness and zero gravity in the parabolic flight?
It was a quick turnaround. I'll tell you, like, so the flight was in October. I can't even believe I'm saying that because it's December right now as we're recording this, and it just time. I've gotten no sense of time anymore during the pandemic. But only a few months before that, where the applications due. And so it had been going around for a little while. You know, people had texted me and emailed me, hey, are you're clearly signing up for this thing, right? You know, and I was in a really, really busy time with the company, and I was just completely underwater. And I actually, like, believe it or not, I really did consider not applying for this. I was just like, I'm super busy, and there's probably no chance I'm going to get selected. You know, that kind of thing, right? I mean, imposter syndrome is real for everybody. I did, though. I was like, yeah, there's no chance I'm not doing this. We gotta do this. And so I sat down, and the application was really straightforward. It was, some questions about what does space mean to you, and, you know, you kind of get a sense of, you know, how people think about the accessibility and disability. Are you comfortable discussing your disability? You know, they were really thoughtful. They were deeply inclusive in their selection criteria, and they were deeply thoughtful in the way that they operationalized the entire process. And I'm not talking only about application now. I'm talking about from application all the way through the flight and even beyond. I've just been so impressed. I've said this several times to folks that the combination of brilliance and kindness is not one that you see in such equal proportions with this kind of group of people. You know, I have the luxury of, you know, playing and working with a lot of smart people in the world, but this many incredibly high caliber smart folks that are also so kind and generous in spirit and in their profession, it's unreal. It's just absolutely next level. And so the application process was, you know, you fill out some perfunctory questions and you fill out a video, you submit a video. And even that was inclusive because they had deaf reviewers, right? So when you were asked to submit a video, you were also asked to submit a transcript of your video per best practices so we can make our content inclusive. And this way, somebody could actually even submit a sign language video because that's their native language, and they would provide a transcript for somebody who couldn't see or understand their sign. So even in the application process, inclusion was baked in at the beginning of this.
And what was that experience like of experiencing zero gravity and weightlessness? What actually happens in a parabolic flight?
So let's go over the what happens first and then talk about what it was like. So what happens is that you're in a modified 727, an aircraft, right? And it's essentially doing parabolas or U's, you know, it's a U shape. And so the way that that works is that you climb up to about 30, 35,000 feet, and then you experience, depending on the angle of the plane, either Martian gravity, lunar gravity, or microgravity, zero gravity. And so you experience that for about 20 to 25 seconds as it's, you know, descending down the U. And then you're pulling 1.8 gravities to go back up, right? So you're actually, you weigh almost twice as much as your body weight on the way back up. That's the part that a lot of people don't know about these flights, is that you're pulling those 1.8 Gs on the other side. And, you know, what it's like is, it's magical. I've told people, you know, I'm a pretty rational, like hyper-rational person. I don't really use magical very often as a descriptor. But you know, we were on a call, we were on a all hands call last night with the Mission Astro Access folks, and one of the folks, she's a member of the blind team and on the steering committee, on the leadership committee, Sherry, said, "I ran out of adjectives a few months ago." And I thought that that captured it so well, that we've all just kind of run out of descriptive words. But the experience is that you're, what we did was we were on floor mats. So you're in the front cabin of the plane and there's no seats there, right? The seats are all in the back. There's about 30, 40 seats in the back. That's it. The front half of the plane, front portion of the fuselage is all just, you know, padding and stuff. And that's where you can experience microgravity. So we were on yoga mats on the floor. And then they basically, you know, you can feel it. The gravity releases you, right? And, you know, you slip the surly bonds of Earth, to quote that poem. And then you are either experiencing lunar, Martian, or no gravity. So you could push off with a finger from the ground and you are floating. You are absolutely 100% floating or spinning in air. You can go from a seated position, like for example, in lunar gravity, where you weigh 1/6 your body weight. You could just push off from your hands and you're standing, right? Just from pushing off from your hands. Just a little touch, little push. So it's a great, incredible feeling.
Were you disorientated at all during it? Because many of us, you know, sort of blind and partially sighted people, we rely on sort of hearing sounds and, you know, our spatial awareness to sort of orientate ourselves. And if you're in zero gravity, you know, you're possibly not experiencing all that.
You're not experiencing all that. And so how do you know which way up is? How do you know if you are spinning? Because if I put you in a chair, like an office chair, and I spin you around in it, you're going to know that you're spinning, right? The air is coming across your skin. The fluid inside of your ear is going to be sloshing around. So you're going to maybe feel a little bit of dizziness, you know, that lightheadedness. You're going to know that you're moving around. If you're in microgravity, you don't even know if you've got spin. You don't know that you've imparted some inertia onto yourself until maybe your hand brushes against something and you're like, "Oh, I was moving." And so, yeah, it can be very disorienting. However, I'll tell you, there's two things that were interesting here. First is this flight, because of the modifications they've made to the plane, they've stripped out a lot of the padding, not like the physical padding to keep people safe, but the acoustic stuff that keeps the plane kind of quiet in a commercial flight. So imagine the loudest commercial flight you have ever been on, and then multiply it by three or four. And that is how loud. This thing is loud, loud, loud. You are yelling to the person 6 feet away from you so that you can be heard by them. And so that is the level of background noise we're dealing with. And, you know, as somebody who's blind, that means that all the other cues you might rely on and use, they're gone. They're absolutely buried. And so we were playing around with different, you know, this wasn't just for fun, right? We were doing experiments on this flight. So we had sound cues and vibrotactile affordances set up and all these other kinds of things to figure out how can we facilitate station keeping, knowing you can stay in one place for somebody who's blind and low vision, as well as for our other ambassadors with various disabilities, right? How can you facilitate, "I want to go from here to there." How do you do that in a reasonable way, in a logical way, wayfinding, you know? All the stuff that we might take for granted on Earth, you know, that we might use canes and service animals and things like that for, how do you do those things in microgravity were some of the experiments and problems we were trying to solve on this flight. But none of all of what I've just said was the most disorienting thing. The most disorienting thing was negative gravity. So what happens sometimes is that as the plane's going down, it might hit like a pocket of air, something like that. You know, I mean, you're going through atmosphere. It's not perfect, right? And so then you actually experience some gravity pulling you up towards the roof of the plane, towards the ceiling of the plane. So normally you're just neutral. You only have whatever inertia that you've imparted onto yourself, all of those laws, you know, from Newton that we learned in grade school and all that. But now you actually have a force that's pulling you up, and you didn't do anything to do that. And that, to be honest with you, was the most disorienting thing. And what's interesting is that wouldn't actually happen, in my understanding, on a suborbital or orbital flight. That's an artifact of doing the parabolic trajectories for these flights. But that was the most disorienting, because you didn't do something to end up somewhere else. So now you're wondering why you're there.
What lessons from your experience do you think that will be fed back into inclusive design back here, and maybe into some of the work that you do with Prime Access Consulting?
I think there's a couple of things. You know, a lot of times when we think about design, design is conveying something, whether it's information, whether it's an aesthetic, whether it's an experience, right, a feeling, within a set of constraints. Right? That's one definition of design. And so imagine what it means when you get to change all of those constraints. What does that actually mean for your problem solving? What does it mean for the affordances and the types of features and tools that you use? What does that mean for the ways that you think about going about doing something that has been so ordinary for all of your life that you don't give it a second thought? And that level of thinking, that different perspective, that lens, if you will, is beneficial not only when thinking about designing in microgravity and for space, but also here on Earth. We spend a lot of time on Earth getting it wrong. I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, we live in a very deeply disabling environment, whether it's lack of door openers on buildings or lack of accessible information for those who are blind or low vision, lack of, you know, mobility affordances and accommodations on various forms of transportation for anybody who uses various forms of assistive technologies. And the list goes on and on and on. Well, if we have the opportunity to design spaces fresh, because all these other constraints have changed, like there's no gravity, there's no air outside, we have to figure out temperature, all these things, well, then it's an incredible blank canvas for us to then go, all right, and also we need to build inclusion in as a tier one, absolutely high priority item from the concepting phase all the way through engineering and building it out and implementation and testing, so that we can then build something that is not only, by the way, inclusive and accessible, so that we can have, you know, para-astronauts and folks with diverse abilities participating as scientists and as tourists and folks like that in space and this new space age we're in. But also, don't forget that this is a critical safety issue, right? When you have an astronaut that might have no use of their vision, they're a sighted astronaut, but they might not be able to use their eyes because maybe they are damaged as a result of an accident, or there's, you know, something else that is taking their attention that is even more critical, right? Having these other affordances we've built in for a blind astronaut, like vibrations in the suit or a sonified gyroscope that makes sounds to let you know your orientation, or tactile affordances on the walls and floor and ceiling to let you know about wayfinding clues within the environment. All of these things all of a sudden become absolutely critical for that person, even though they, quote unquote, can see just fine, right? So it's not only a matter of equity, but a matter of safety as well.
Technology is getting better all the time, and we only have to look at our smartphones and other smart devices. Do you think that there will come a time when a blind or partially sighted person might go into space, walk on Mars, or work in the International Space Station?
Yes, absolutely. Unequivocally and absolutely. That's not even a question for me in terms of if. It's a question of when. It is that certain of an event, as far as I am concerned. What we want to do in Mission Astro Access, and this, I'm going to extend your question, if I may, to not only a blind astronaut, but anyone with diverse abilities, with different disabilities, is accelerate that timeline. Instead of saying, oh yeah, that'll probably happen in 100 years, what if it happens in 12, right? Because, you know, we haven't really figured out like extending human lifespans too long, and I want to be around to see it and feel it and experience it. And so yes to all of them, to orbit, to suborbital flight, to new space stations that are being built and space hotels, to the moon and also to Mars, right? Don't get me wrong, these are hard problems to solve, not because of disability, just because space is hard. Space is really, really hard. But some of the smartest, most amazing people are working on it. And what we're trying to do here is make sure that also some of the smartest and most amazing persons with disabilities are able to work on it and make sure that the shape, the topology of the solutions we come up with are fully inclusive from the beginning.
What might be next for you, Sina, in your space journey?
We'll see. We've been talking about some future flights. There's a science flight scheduled for next year. We're potentially thinking of some future flights as well that haven't been announced yet. You know, so there's those in terms of the microgravity flights, in terms of the parabolic flights, because we have to figure out, right, the different affordances like I was talking about, right? How do we solve some of these wayfinding problems? And how do we solve for a loud environment that, you know, a new spacecraft these days may not be as loud as the parabolic flights, but it's still going to be an acoustically non-quiet environment. So how do you solve for sound beacons and things like that? But the natural progression, I feel, and I think some other folks feel the same way, is to go from parabolic flight to suborbital, right? And then from suborbital to orbital. That's sort of a pretty logical progression. And so I'm very much hoping that I have the opportunity not only to experience some future microgravity flights, which I'm super excited about because I'm really interested in some of the technological and inclusive design solutions we can come up with there, but then to extend that to suborbital and orbital flight. And I would love to be able to experience that myself and to participate and just play in that kind of ecosystem, because it's absolutely the future and it's such an exciting time to be alive.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Sina Bahram, for chatting with me here on RNIB Connect Radio and sharing your experiences of weightlessness and zero gravity.
Thanks so much. Have a good one.